This is old news, but Lena Dunham came out with a new show. And, you know, people have been waiting. They've been in anticipation. She's having her renaissance. People are like, we're so sorry. Not everyone is like, we're so sorry, Lena Dunham. If you see one of her interviews make it to, like, the wrong part of the internet, you're like, oh, no, people are still really horrible about Lena Dunham. But for the most part, the people who matter like her.
Have been anticipating.
We've been anticipating. So the show is called Too Much, blah, blah, blah. You've probably heard of it. And it stars Meg Stalter of Hacks, a comedian. And it's hard for me to say it's on the level of Girls by any means. I do think that it's, like, lacking Lena Dunham. Like, I do think Lena Dunham, on top of being an amazing writer, is a really great actress for these specific types of roles. And
yeah,
it's hard not to have her in there. She just has this kind of naturalism. And she knows how to recite her dialogue in, like, the exact right way that sometimes I could hear Meg Stalter doing it and it kind of sounds like a Lena Dunham impression of the way she, like, recites the lines. But that's not her fault. Like, I think she's still doing a great job. But no, I've been liking it so far.
Okay, that's so interesting because I've only seen the first episode. I watched it with some friends here and we were all kind of iffy about it. I think for me, because you can hear the voice, like the girl's voice, but it does feel like it's not, I don't know. I think that the genius of Girls, or like the strength of it, comes from how ingrained its actors and like creators and everyone were in the world that it was reproducing and commenting on, that it felt like there was so much truth in there that it like hit in a much more immediate way.
Whereas, it was real, like, to them. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, whereas I've only seen an episode, so I'm probably speaking too soon. But I think I found that, like, with Too Much, it wasn't quite doing that for me yet. I think, like, the pilot of Girls is just so hard to compete with. Like, that's such an insane standard to try and live up to, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. I really enjoy Meg Stalter as a character actress. I think she's great on Hacks. I think she's really funny.
She's a really beautiful speaking voice. She's like a sexy voice.
Yeah, she does. When, like, I watch her videos and, like, I've, like, watched her in interviews and, like, she cracks me up. But I think that in order to, like, be grounded in the way where, like, Girls, you're like, this is ridiculous, but it still has, like, this emotional resonance, I kind of wonder if she necessarily is that kind of performer. But again, this is based off of one episode, so, like, I could be jumping the gun.
I don't fully disagree. A bunch of my friends were also feeling that she is kind of, like, overacting. I haven't been that put off by her acting, but I do think there are some scenes that you're like, I don't know, she just feels a bit incongruous with the rest of the cast maybe sometimes. Also, I didn't realize that the show is, like, very much about Lena Dunham's life and her breakup with Jack Antonoff. And holy fuck, she's taking swings. Like, I won't reveal anything, but you're like, whoa, okay. That's crazy. Like, she's pissed. She wrote it, like, with her husband, apparently, and it's about, like, how they met. But some of the characterizations of the Jack Antonoff surrogate character is, like, pretty crazy. I mean, really? Maybe he really is like that in real life, but I was like, whoa.
Okay, I'm excited for that. I'm also like, I'm excited to kind of see this story as someone who also fucked off to London.
Yeah, I think you'll specifically like it. I wonder what you'll think about, and British people in general, just to lump you in with the Brits, but what they'll think about her characterization of England. Because, like, part of why I like Girls is because I really like consuming media about New York, especially now that I live in New York. I'm like, oh, I can, you know, I can really relate to it. All the books I've been reading recently, for some reason, are all taking place in New York, even if I don't intend them to. It's very strange. I guess it's not that crazy. Everything takes place here. But I feel like it being in England kind of loses me a bit, because, like, part of the draw of British shows for me and, like, shows set in London are the British humor and, like, the specific witticisms of that. And, like, the perviness of it, whatever, that I feel like Lena Dunham doesn't lack wit at all or perviness, but I feel like, I don't know, maybe there's, like, a dissonance, but, like, I'm not saying it's inaccurate. I'm not British. There's just something, like, I would almost just rather her be in New York, almost. But maybe you would like it and you would feel some truth there.
What struck me at first was just that when she gets to East London, like, her reaction to it, I understand it's a sort of, like, you know, her romanticized version of England being challenged immediately by, like, being in East London. But also, East London reminds me a lot of New York. And she kind of reacts to it in this way where she's, like, shocked by, like, the grittiness of certain things, where I'm like, are you not coming from New York City? Like, I don't really see how, like, there's a parallel between those two places that I find strange that, like, the show kind of ignores or feels like it's not acknowledging when she gets there.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that, except that her, the way that they depict her in New York is also confusing to me. I usually hate when people are like, oh, this show's unrealistic because it shows these characters who don't make that much money living in these crazy apartments. But, like, people will use that argument about Friends, and it's, like, so clear in Friends that she inherited that from her grandmother and that it's rent stabilized. And then, like, Joey and Chandler's apartment is, like, disgusting. And in Sex and the City, it's like, okay, this is the 90s. Like, and it's also, like, a studio alcove. It's not, like, it's some massive apartment that Carrie lives in. And she clearly acquired it in, like, the very early 90s as well. Like, I don't know. It's just people being so just willfully blind towards the way that prices change. And, like, also, who cares? But with this, I was a little bit like, what? Because they live in a garden apartment, which is, like, the apartments that are kind of at the foot of, like, a brownstone. And they're, like, a first-floor apartment. It's a bit like a sub-basement in Toronto, except, I mean, obviously, kind of a bit nicer. But the show insinuates that they live in Dumbo. And I could be wrong, but I'm like, this is her and her boyfriend in New York, like, her ex-boyfriend. He's supposed to be, like, a struggling music journalist. And she's, like, she's not a PA. I think she's, like, a production coordinator. But I am, like, okay, I'm struggling to understand how you afford that apartment. When I feel like Lena Dunham's whole thing is talking about how difficult it is to live in New York. So maybe it is supposed to be aspirational in that, like, Emily in Paris, Sex and the City way a little bit. And that's why, you know, she wears those, like, weird blazer outfits. She also wears this, like, kind of fancy, yeah, she wears fancy clothing a lot. Yeah,
she wears a suit when she, like, gets off the plane. I was like, oh, she's wearing a blazer right now. Like, this is crazy.
And then she kind of suggests that she has to wear that for work. And I'm like, what? I feel like I know a lot of people who do that job, and that is not what you're wearing. But I don't care. I'm not saying this because it, like, this as a knock against the show. It is just genuine confusion.
I'm, like, very curious to see where it goes, because I've heard really great things, but I wasn't. Again, it's like, I feel like you watched the first episode of Girls and you have such a good idea of this world, who these people are. It doesn't feel like overly expositional. Like, it just feels like you've become sat down in the middle of this, like, social circle, and this is a different kind of story, and, like, it's not fair to just compare it to Girls, but it I didn't feel gripped in the same way, I guess, immediately. But I'm not gonna write it off.
I think it'll have growing pains. I've been enjoying it so far. There are some extreme Lena Dunham isms, like, they'll have drug party slow motion silly dancing scene, like, you know, that kind of stuff that you're like, oh, she's back on her bullshit. But no, I like it. I also just, like, want the best for her, so I'm like, yay.
Did you see that she identifies as a Shosh?
I did see that. She went on the HBO Girls Rewatch podcast, and she said that she identifies as a Shosh, and then she describes things as, like, Shoshi, and I was like, okay. I was like, that feels like a convenient narrative, Lena Dunham, but that's also cute. I, too, would love to be a Shosh. Unfortunately, I'm a Marnie.
I think Marnie's being reclaimed. Allison Williams is, like, having this sort of resurgence, and she's going around, and people are, like, revisiting and, like, reappraising Marnie as a
Marnie's
character.
Like, hot and bitchy, I don't know, and, like, anal retentive. That's fine, I'll take it.
I'm unfortunately a Hannah, which is, like, the worst one to be.
You are a Hannah. That is not okay. As a Marnie, I absolutely hate Jessa. I hate Jessa with a passion. I actually find her hard to watch. Like, I feel the inclination to skip her scenes. I hate that character so much. Like, I hate her. She reminds me of girls I went to school with. Like, the eccentric socialite, like, completely socially oblivious or just, like, downright awful. And I hate that character. I cannot relate to her. I do not feel bad for her. So I think she's the worst character you can be. Hannah's everyone. Hannah's, like, Carrie. Everyone's Hannah.
Yeah, but, like, I called my mom out for this recently. I was like, you've told me to my face multiple times that, like, she reminded you so much of me. And my mom was like, I said that? Like, I'm so sorry.
Probably as a parent, she was like, yeah, that's...
Yeah, this is also teenage me, probably my most self-absorbed, like, you know, iteration of myself. But yeah, I was like, this is really painful and cruel of you, mother.
We are all Hannahs. It's okay. Said everyone ever.
And speaking of which, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maia.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about beauty on the internet, social media may have snatched our faces, but has it also snatched our souls? If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have monthly bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, you can feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot. So let's just jump right in. Maya, would you like to explain to listeners what Facetune is? Like the app?
It's an app I have. I bought it in 2017, I want to say. I was ashamed. It was my Christmas present to myself. It was like $3. I don't do anything crazy. I'm not like restructuring my whole face. But if I have like one pimple in a photo, I'm like, well, this pimple does not define me. I'm going to take this bitch out. And I completely acknowledge that that is being insecure and that it goes against a lot of my values. But we are all fallible creatures, you know, like, what can I say? It's an app wherein you're able to kind of like soft Photoshop yourself. It's like extremely user-friendly Photoshop that's like specifically designed for selfies and like pictures of the face, essentially, and pictures of your body. So it has like a restructuring function where you can like actually take the image and like warp it. It has like a smoothing function. It has a teeth whitening function, which I abused back in 2017 and it looked really bad. It is a function where you can like enhance the details of your face, which just kind of like makes your face look crunchy.
Yeah, like you sharpen the image basically.
Yeah, it's like a sharpening feature basically where I would use it on my eyelashes back in 2017. It looked bad. That was the era where it was like, oh, putting like a dot of highlighter on the end of your nose. Like the worst fucking era for everything. Yeah. I remember I went to Paris. I like visited my friend and he called me strobe face. And I was like, you're not wrong, babe.
No.
I did not blend my highlighter properly. There was like a big, just like shiny dot on my nose. And that shit looked bad in person. And I hope that we have come to a time where we can acknowledge that. But yes, Facetune kind of dominated popular culture for like the mid to late 2010s. It's everywhere. People obviously, I think, still use it. And it got to the point where you could really tell if someone was using Facetune. But to the extent that women could tell, and I think a lot of men couldn't and still can't.
And that really kind of shocks me. Not shocks me, it doesn't shock me at all, but it fascinates me, I would say. Like, this sort of inability to, like, decipher when something has been heavily airbrushed or edited.
Concerning.
I think I've had you take out pimples of mine on Facetune, with your Facetune.
And I feel really bad about it. I'm sorry. I think Hannah's pimples are beautiful and everyone should see them and I should see them and I just feel bad being the one to do it. When you do it unto others, it doesn't feel good. Like, you're like, I'm taking away my friend's beautiful face.
She certainly, like, you had my my consent and even my wishes to Facetune my face. So I would say I forgive you.
This feels like therapy.
But yeah, like you said, Facetune is a photo editing app specifically designed for, like, editing and, like, beautifying photos of people, like portraits. It was created in 2013, and within 2 years of its launch, it had already made about $18 million. By 2017, when you downloaded it, it was Apple's most popular paid app. I didn't realize, but I guess that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I'm trying to think of like what other app you would pay for that'd be useful. I'm like, oh, New York Times cooking app, I guess. Like, what's more useful than Facetune?
That's subscription-based. Like, I think, like, single pay per-use apps have also just kind of depopularized over the years.
I wonder why.
But yeah, so obviously, like, Facetune, though it was, like, newer in its form as a photo editing app, the concept of, you know, essentially yossifying your image was nothing new by the time it came around. I think for as long as we've been able to render human beings into image form, we've like found ways to like make them look better. Portrait painters probably edited, or not edited, they probably painted their subjects' features to look a bit more appealing. And then like photo editors in the pre-digital age would employ all these different darkroom tricks to retouch their photos. Like they'd literally airbrush things. So then like with the advent of digital photography, we got stuff like Adobe Photoshop, which opened up like this whole new world of possibilities for people who wanted to edit photos. But obviously Photoshop itself was something you had to learn to use. And especially like earlier on in the computer age, it wasn't something that like most people would be using or like have that kind of access to or literacy with.
Are you saying it was not democratized? Are you saying it was gatekept?
I just might be. But with Photoshop, even though obviously people have been editing photos for as long as there have been like images in photo and fashion magazines, Photoshop brought in like a whole new sort of range of things that you could do to an image. And as people were like learning that skill, you can kind of see like throughout the years, the trial and error of photo manipulation and like editors and photographers seeing what they could get away with editing. I don't know if you remember like any particular instances of egregious Photoshop, but I'm gonna send you two. The first one is an image of Kate Winslet. It's from 2002. She'd been Photoshopped to look thinner, but whoever edited it forgot to Photoshop her mirror reflection, because in the photo she's like facing a mirror.
And she's so sexy in the mirror is the funniest part.
Well, it's also just like not what Kate Winslet looked like in 2002.
Well, she's known for being curvy.
Yeah. So that was for GQ. And Whoa. Then the second is a Ralph Lauren ad that like immediately got flack because they had edited the model.
Is this Brooke Shields?
No, it's, I don't know the model's name, but it does look kind of like Brooke Shields. But she basically has the proportions of a Disney princess, like the longest and narrowest waist. I don't even think that that's like biologically like possible for her body to look like that.
Like, I'm sure there's someone out there, but it's like extremely rare. Yeah. Yeah. She looks like a Winx doll.
And like they kept her shoulders kind of proportional too. Like, it's just like very obviously.
It's just bad. Like it's badly done. Yeah.
But I think a lot of like these kinds of instances definitely from the beginning have kept people like very dubious, very skeptical about Photoshop. And obviously like from its inception, there's been a lot of concerns about like how instances like this would impact young women specifically consuming the media that this was included in.
It's like all we talked about in media class.
That's what I was just about to ask you about. Yeah, I have such vivid memories of having teachers be like, look at this image. Now, does this look like a regular woman to you? What looks different about this image? And then like kind of pointing to all the places where it's like been retouched or like videos where it shows you before and after and all of that.
It was like early attempts at media literacy, except it was just the same subject every year to the point that like by the last year of it, I was like, okay. I feel like they could have taught media literacy from a wide array of angles that would have probably benefited a lot of students, you know, like reading newspaper headlines, etc. But it was definitely helpful, and it also feels like only girls had to do this, pretty mm-hmm. obviously, because all the men we know were absolutely fucking idiotic when it comes to being able to detect any of this.
Like we said earlier, I just feel like from a young age, I think I had it ingrained in me to be dubious about all these types of images and to just assume that photo editing and like manipulation was just a standard step in the art of like editorial images.
Yeah.
And so, or commercial images as well. So it does kind of boggle my mind that this seems to be kind of a one-sided education, like mm-hmm. you said. But then, yeah, I think that also there's just like so many stories and instances like the ones I've shown you throughout the years that it kind of also feels like maybe we had that discussion so often that it just sort of became less shocking over time. And I think the idea of photo manipulation just became like so ubiquitous that it, I don't know, it like also stop becoming a thing that, like, upset me, because I feel like it just became that normalized.
And when school teaches it to you, you're just gonna eye roll, even if you know it's true, and even if it actually subconsciously bothers you, it feels like dare, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, don't talk to me about mm-hmm. drugs, you know? Like, you know it's bad, but you're kind of like, ugh, like, I don't know. You're just fatigued by it. Like, if your school teacher's yelling at you about it, you're like, well, okay.
I'm like, I like these glossy fashion magazines, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, it becomes, like, uncool.
Yeah, definitely. It just feels, like, redundant.
Yeah, and redundant, especially if they're teaching it to you every year without any, like, evolution in the education. Thanks, TDSB.
So then we've had, like, this kind of groundwork set for the idea of, like, Photoshop and photo manipulation. We've been aware of it for ages. When Facetune comes around then in 2013, becoming just basically, like, the most contemporary edition of this, why do we think that it blew up in such a massive way?
Well, I think that Photoshop is hard. I don't do it. I outsource that labor to Hannah with, you know, every thumbnail I do. Hannah is now running the social media. I don't know if you guys have seen the older posts on our social media, but, like, they don't look good. I'm not good at Photoshop. Hannah's much better at it.
Oh, stop it.
Graphic design is her passion. And so, you know, like, it's hard. Whereas, like, for lay people such as myself, Facetune is so easy. Like, the user experience is so good. It's so easy to do. Like, that patch function where you just, like, you just literally put a different piece of skin over top of the pimple, it's like, that sounds so disgusting, but it's so easy, and it's like, it's intuitive in a way that Photoshop isn't. There's literally zero learning curve, really. And so I would see that, like, having that, like, a little pocket app that costs like $3 just flat is so convenient. I ate it up right away. I was like, perfect. And then I also experimented with, like, making myself look really bad as well, because I thought that was fun.
No, exactly. You've hit the nail on the head. Rebecca Jennings wrote an article for Vox in 2019 on Facetune, and that's going to be, like, a source that I use throughout the episode. But she attributes Facetune's popularity to its simplicity as well, which, yeah, makes a lot of sense. I think Photoshop, I'm still learning new things on Photoshop every time I use it, because I didn't take classes or whatever, and there are so many things that have no obvious labels or buttons or function. It's not user-friendly, it's expensive, it's not something, I've never edited a personal photo on Photoshop to be, like, put up on social media either.
And, like, the other alternative that was free when we were growing up was PixieMash. I don't know if you ever used that, but it was not, like,
I don't know what that is.
It was, like, where I would make the rest of the background black and white, but then myself, like, in color, you know, that kind of, or, like, make one, like, my shirt is in color.
I did that with Picnic.
Oh, sorry, and also Picnic. I used PixieMash, but Picnic was the more popular one. But no, if you wanted something more sophisticated and, like, to actually Photoshop something, yeah, the learning curve is crazy. It's the kind of thing, like, you know, teaching myself how to edit on, like, Premiere Pro, for example, having to look up, like, a YouTube tutorial for every little small task I wanted to do, and then you kind of accumulate those skills, and then you have the basic skill set, but I still don't have, like, the art of editing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, my editing skills are still pretty rudimentary. Like, I know how to use the most basic aspects of Premiere, but it's not intuitive to me. I don't have, like, a crazy workflow on there that's, like, the same as the guys I know who are actual editors. And the same can be said for Photoshop.
Yeah, well, I think, like, ultimately, like, these are professional tools, which is why, like, they're expensive and they aren't intuitive. And they're often, like, taught through courses and classes because, like, they're not actually meant for the everyday person.
Which is fine.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that Facetune sort of then took those things and made them for the everyday person, but took the things that they knew the everyday person would want. But also, like, why do we think there would be this increased demand for photo editing technology for the everyday person that, like, Facetune provides? Like, why do we suddenly want it?
Hannah, that's a really interesting question. It's interesting that you ask that. So
it's a thinker.
It's a thinker. I think it would be the rise of visual social media platforms, photo sharing platforms, such as Facebook, Instagram.
You're right.
MySpace? But MySpace predated that.
MySpace is pre... And even, like, honestly, Facebook.
Wait, listen up. The other thing is that, you know, MySpace, you know, thinking about this with MySpace, you're thinking about this with, like, early Facebook albums. The camera quality was shit back then. It was delightfully garbage, pixelated as fuck, and, like, the style of editing was much more exaggerated. Like, you could put filters over your photos and no one would laugh at you. You know what I mean? Whereas, like, this was kind of the introduction of the era of much higher quality iPhone cameras, much more pared down editing. Like, I'm not putting my freaking Kelvin filter on my photos anymore. I'm not putting my white border up anymore. Like, this is the real deal, okay?
It's not little kid stuff. We're also just, like, seeing and being seen at, like, an unprecedented scale, like, even more than Facebook, because, like, Instagram has just opened up this world of possibilities where, like, we're being seen by strangers, we're being seen by, like, whole networks of people, and, like, we're being represented by images. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Facebook, you have your profile picture. Maybe that's, like, the most important part of, like, the pictorial curation of your page, but, like, obviously Instagram is a whole other game. So it does, I think, also just increase, like, a demand for aesthetically pleasing photos, obviously. So, like, photo editing was once reserved for celebrities and models because Photoshop itself as, like, a program and, like, as a skill was something that you had to learn. It was, like, there was a gatekeeping aspect to it. And so it was mostly used by people who were being photographed professionally, for the most part, at least, like, in the sense of, like, for vanity purposes. And, you know, regular people, our photos weren't really being seen by people outside of our immediate circles. So then, as that's changed, and, like, as how we present ourselves online is, like, you know, more important than ever, and maybe, like, even more important than as we appear in person a lot of the times these days, it just makes sense that there would be more of an incentive. But still, like, just as there was this sort of strong cultural backlash against Photoshop when we started becoming more cognizant of it, the popularity of Facetune didn't really shield its users from backlash either. Are you familiar with a little Instagram account called CelebFace?
Oh my gosh, am I? I love that shit.
Yeah.
I got it when, I mean, it's probably still like this, but you had to request to join.
Yeah, me too, back in the day.
Yeah, which is always like, oh my god, just exposing your own ass, you know, like, you're like, oh no, yeah, I really do want to see this.
I don't know how I even came across it, but it's like same with Dumois. I like requested to follow Dumois back in the day when it was like private.
You know, you're powerful when you're like a really popular and like growing in popularity private account. Yeah, I love CelebFace. If I was a celeb, I would hate CelebFace, but...
So for people who don't know CelebFace, it's not clear that, like, it hasn't posted in over a year. So, like, I would say it was. It doesn't seem very active right now. So it was an Instagram account dedicated to exposing public figures who edited their Instagram photos or had, like, undergone cosmetic procedures. It was started in 2015 by a young woman named Anna. And the account's bio reads, "Welcome to reality. If you don't want to see the truth, leave this page." Which, gotta love the dramatics of that.
Truth hurts, babe.
And basically they would post things like if Kylie Jenner went to an event and she posted like a photo of herself and had it all edited, CelebFace might find a different photo of her from that same event, post it in like a slide show form thing. So you'd see the photo that Kylie posted, you'd slide it, and you'd see what she actually looks like at the event.
And it would be like they'd be really good at finding the exact same angle of photo to show you, and like they'd really zoom in. It was rude. It was like poor galore.
Yeah, exactly. Or like they'd post things to just like point out. Sometimes they'd post videos of people. Like they'd be like, here's this person edited up, and then here's them, like, actually moving in the space, which also felt...
The other thing they do is post... there was something that you could use, like, some sort of app that would allow you to actually, like, Photoshop a video of yourself, but it was always really glitchy, so, like, someone's butt would, like, expand and then, like, deflate within the same video, and they would post that as well and kind of, like, zoom in on where the video was falsified, I guess.
Yeah, no, they would do that, and then they'd also do something where they'd post, like, let's say four images, making up a square, and each image would be, like, this celebrity over the years, so you could see how their face had changed over the course of, like, I feel like they did that to Dove Cameron all the time. Like, they'd show someone so you could see the progression of their plastic surgery, basically.
There were a few favorites, for sure. Dove Cameron, there was a girl who actually went to our high school, who became famous on TikTok.
Musical.ly girl?
Yeah, we didn't know her. She was much younger than us, but, like, she would always end up on there. She's, like, a famous TikToker.
I don't remember that. Maybe it was a different account.
But, yeah, yeah. I don't know. Because she would, like, really Facetune her stuff. Yeah.
I think, and, like, obviously this was the era where that was, like, really prominent as well. And I think there did become a bit of, like, an almost a sport of catching Facetune in the act. And so to this day, like, Celebface still has over 1 million followers on Instagram. And it's been praised by a variety of outlets for exposing the many discrepancies between social media and reality. I mean, you're saying, like, I definitely enjoyed partaking in it back in the day.
The little rat brain in me is like, let's see this. Let's see this.
It's satisfying. And so looking at Celebface in that era, you do start to notice certain trends in the ways that celebrities have edited or altered their appearances. Can you think of any of, like, the specific editing trends that were prominent at the time? Or, like, the looks that people were creating on Facetune?
Yeah, it would be, like, heavily blurred skin. There's, like, a smooth feature on Facetune, and then there's the double smooth feature. And all I gotta tell you is don't use double smooth, because double smooth does not a human make. It makes something else.
Mariam Cosby abuses that double smooth. Mariam Cosby of the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, of course.
Well, yeah, older women would take it on, like, kind of shittier phone cameras somehow. I don't know how Mariam Cosby has bad ones, but, like, they'll take it on kind of, like, bad quality, or maybe with bad quality lighting, and then apply the smooth filter, and they'll have this, like, weird amorphous face with, like, really highly defined eyes. It's very frightening.
Yes, the defined eyes is the scariest part.
Yeah. They'd be like, because they'd put the sharpening feature, the details feature on the eyes. They would take the, like, structure feature, and they would kind of give themselves, like, much smaller chins. It is the most revealing of someone's dysmorphia. Like, it kind of externalizes that dysmorphia and, like, puts an image to it. Like, this is what this person would like to see themselves looking like in their head. And sometimes it's, like, shocking what someone thinks looks good. But yeah, they would, like, shave down the chin to this, like, tiny little point. They would, like, make the nose smaller. They would enhance the boobs a little bit. They would snatch the waist. They would enhance the butt, that kind of thing. They would really whiten the teeth, which was always a dead giveaway. Yeah, I think it would mostly be that. And then obviously, like, expanding the lips a bit. But the features that allow you to warp it are not good. Like, if you warp your mouth, let's say, it'll shrink your nose because it's an image. Oh, yeah. Right? So if you were to pull up on your mouth, like, the upper lip, your nose and your, like, everything above that basically gets smushed. And then you have to reorient that too. And you just end up looking less than human.
And also, like, if you're not, like, a master at this, something is going to be kind of, like, pushed out of line and you're going to miss it. And I think so many people fell victim to that, where they were, like, in the process of trying to tweak another thing, made something else look really weird.
Usually it'd be like a floorboard, like, you know, it would be kind of like the more set, less fleshy things behind you, like a door frame that would get curved in the process.
Yeah, exactly. Or just, like, sometimes something on the face just be a little, like, squiggly, I suppose. But yeah, there was also, like, I think a big trend of sort of, like, enlarging the eyes, making them slightly upturned.
Oh, you mean the lateral canthal tilt or whatever?
Well, yes, like the fox eye.
The positive canthal tilt or whatever.
Yes, exactly. But then, especially, like, on the face, like, all of these features came to be known as making up Instagram face. So another major source for this episode was Gia Tolentino's 2019 essay, The Age of Instagram Face, which I'm sure many of the people listening have read. It's been, like, a really great resource for this episode. And so I'm going to use Tolentino's description of Instagram face from the piece. She says, "It's a young face, of course, with poreless skin and plump, high cheekbones. It has cat-like eyes and long, cartoonish lashes. It has a small, neat nose and full, lush lips. It looks at you coyly but blankly, as if its owner has taken half a Klonopin and is considering asking you for a private jet ride to Coachella. The face is distinctly white but ambiguously ethnic. It suggests a National Geographic composite illustrating what Americans will look like in 2050, if every American of the future were to be a direct descendant of Kim Kardashian West, Bella Hadid, Emily Ratajkowski, and Kendall Jenner, who looks exactly like Emily Ratajkowski."
Yeah, my friend calls it no face. It's a face that you know is pretty because adheres to the beauty standards, but like nothing about the face within me like registers as attractive. You know what I mean? Like it can be pretty, yeah. but it's not attractive because it's like so vague. Like it's a face that you could not, you would, like if one of these girlies, okay, let's say, committed arson upon your house, you saw her running away, but you didn't get a good view of her. They were like, they lined a bunch of them up. They lined up these like Kendall Jenner derivatives. You would not be able to pick her out of a lineup. That was a really long way of saying you would not be able to pick her out of a lineup. You know, if she robbed your store that you, where you sell activated charcoal soap, if she robbed your store, she's a kleptomaniac. You would not be able to pick her out of a lineup.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You'd be like, detective, she had long, dark hair, high cheekbones.
Oh, scary little button nose and like undefined large poofy lips. But yeah, it's no face for sure.
No face is very funny. It's almost like someone has so many features that like your brain reads as attractive at once that like none of them stand out in a way that doesn't register.
Yeah, it's like the symmetry is too symmetrical.
My mom, I'm really calling her out in this episode.
Oh my god, poor Deirdre.
My mom said also that my face is asymmetrical. She said I'm a Hannah and I have an asymmetrical face, and now I'm just very cognizant of that. I have a really great mom, just so.
Your mom is amazing. Everyone knows. That's sexy. I think when someone has teeth, I just firmly believe that attraction and beauty are not necessarily the same thing, or like whatever. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But, like, I think attraction is so important and, like, gets lost in a lot of these beauty standard conversations where something that drives me crazy that I think is so hot is when someone has, like, a mild overbite and, like, two front teeth that are longer than the rest of their teeth. I think that is so hot and beautiful and sexy, and, like, that is not considered a beauty standard. You know what I mean?
I mean, I think about the girl from The White Lotus who, like, gets so much flack for her teeth. I think her teeth look cool, personally. I don't know. I feel like when I do find someone really good looking, it's because like one thing really stands out a lot of the time. And so I think my brain doesn't get the dopamine fix from just seeing like a very pretty face. I'm like, well, that's not really doing, like that doesn't really trigger anything in me, because I'm like, when you look at a beautiful bouquet of flowers, I'm like, okay, that's nice. I don't know.
Exactly.
So Maya, other than photo editing, what other technology became cheaper and more widely used in the mid-2010s?
I mean, going back to our baby Botox episode, I would venture to say that maybe injectables, filler, got really popular around this time.
That would be correct. Would you say that plastic surgery and cosmetic procedures have become less taboo since our childhood?
Absolutely. I think that when we were growing up, plastic surgery kind of belonged to older women, older female celebrities. Typically, it belongs to like the Joan Collins type, you know what I mean? Like the older women who still had like 80s haircuts and they wore like big blazers and they had it, like they were kind of botched. Or it belongs to kind of like what our culture of the 2000s would call bimbos, derogatory, such as Pamela Anderson, etc. It was heavily stigmatized, mainly because it kind of looked bad. Also, there was misogyny probably at play, but like it also looked bad. It was conspicuous.
It was also like reserved for the wealthy and vain, essentially, who are like very easy people to demonize in the culture. Like they're very easy people to kind of point and laugh at when something doesn't look great and when it is conspicuous, which, yeah, for the longest time, like what you were seeing were these celebrities that we already kind of regard as like superficial, then doubling down on that in a way that sometimes or often comes back to bite them. So definitely more taboo. I think it was like kind of an instant way to make fun of someone. Like if you were doing like a sketch show or something, like you could put on like some prosthetic plastic surgery and like that would be a joke in and of itself.
Yeah. Whereas like as we discovered in our baby Botox episode, the more that these things started to be marketed towards younger demographics, the more it became like an every person thing. So it's like you can't really stigmatize something that everyone's doing.
Exactly. Yeah. I was overheard like a bunch of girls the other day talking about their Botox. And I was like, surely these girls are 23. And I thought it was like so fascinating. But it's just like that normal. Like they were like talking about it over drinks.
Whatever mood we're in, we like to surround ourselves with things that match it. whether that's watching a tearjerker when we're feeling blue or listening to the right music to get inspired. It's important to curate the right vibe. That's why we're excited to partner with Mood, an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. And with our promo code REHASH, you can get 20% off your first order on mood.com. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, sleepy time to get you settled for a restful night, or chill out for some needed relaxation. Sure, you can get THC gummies just about anywhere these days, but why not personalize it? Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorsteps. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code REHASH. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code REHASH when you check out to save 20% off your first order.
But yeah, no, back then, like, it cost a ton of money. It was mostly invasive procedures that people would be getting. Like, Lisa Rinna's lips, that didn't come from filler the way that, like, we know it. Like, she got those back in the, like, the 80s or 90s, I'm pretty sure. Like, those lips, there's something else going on with those. And then, like, as we discussed with the BBL episode, it was more dangerous and there was, like, a much longer healing time associated with these more invasive surgeries. It wouldn't be something you'd, like, casually consider the way nowadays, since, like, the invention of Botox and, like, Juvederm. If you were curious about something, you're like, well, it's supposed to only last a few months. Like, I may as well just go to this spa because they're all over the place and, like, get a few injections and worst comes to worst, it quote-unquote goes away, or I dissolve it, or I don't know, like, I've just, like, done this little tweak and people might not even notice, you know? So it's just, like, a very different phenomena, and so, like, became associated with a very different type of person, and a type of person that would obviously, yeah, make it feel way more out of touch as a behavior because those people themselves were out of touch.
Yes.
And then, like you said, like, I think for a long time, we only ever really talked about these treatments when they were obvious and when they looked bad and when they were attributed to, like, aging celebrities or, you know, the Heidi Montags of the world. Is there a moment that you associate or, like, a specific time with the sort of shift from, like, taboo to normalized, or does it feel gradual?
It felt a bit gradual. I think that, like, when we talk, like, cosmeceuticals, for example, like, I think in that cosmeceutical era, that era of preventative Botox, making it seem like people needed it was a big watershed moment, I think. Like, I had a friend who reached out to me after the baby Botox episode and was like, oh my gosh, like, I would have loved to talk to you about this. She's, like, an esthetician, and she was talking about how she basically felt pressured into getting preventative Botox and, like, got it when she was, like, 22. And it was seen as, like, standard. Like, everyone had to get this. And I think that I would mark that as, like, maybe a huge shift in the way that people thought about injectables. Because, like, once you hear something's a need, like, you need to do this or else, it becomes different than, like, oh, this is a frivolous cosmetic endeavor.
Yeah, for sure. It's like, well, obviously we moisturize twice a day. Like, it's kind of falls into that camp eventually.
Yeah, exactly. And that comes with the, like, oh, aging aspect of, like, oh, well, aging equals bad. Like, we haven't unlearned that, so.
Precisely, yeah. And then also, I think with the filler aspect of things, like, a moment I always go back to is in 2015 when Kylie Jenner admitted to receiving lip injections. Because leading up to that, she had this whole narrative of, oh, I've just overlined my lips really well. Like, I've figured out, like, sort of, like, smoke and mirrors way to make it look like my lips are ginormous.
Did you see that TikTok of someone being like, wow, like, Kylie Jenner is a girl's girl because she's being transparent a decade out about her, like, myriad plastic surgery procedures that she's had done. Like, oh my god, what a girl's girl
thing. She's a girl's girl because she told people exactly what she got so they could get the same thing. She's looking out for the girls who want to get the
Kylie Jenner. Which is so funny also because now she's also in the middle of reversing a bunch of things and saying she regrets it. It's like, oh god, I simply can't.
But yeah, when Kylie, like, admitted, I guess it was on the Kardashians, that she'd had the surgery done. I think there had been so much speculation about it leading up to that moment, and everyone sort of knew that she'd had it done, but until she went on the record and admitted it, it was sort of this dance around it. And I think that moment was sort of somehow, like, constructed to feel more like a brave admission than her sort of, like, fessing up to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, she was more coming clean, because it kind of felt like when Kendall Jenner, like, was like, guys, I have an announcement to make. I have acne or something, and did that proactive thing. It kind of felt like that, where she was just, like, admitting to the fact that she had it done in almost, like, a medical kind of pragmatic way.
Yeah, and it was coming on the heels also of that era of people being like, Kylie Jenner's the ugly sister. I think a lot of people forget about that, or some people are way too young to remember that, but, like, that was also a big era of people being like, Kylie Jenner's ugly. So I think, like, her admitting to that, like, there was some sort of, like, personal, more intimate, and, like, somewhat almost tragic angle to what she was saying, which, like, I think resonated with me even more back then than it does now, like, years out, when it's like, you know, she's barely recognizable, and, like, most people have even forgotten about any of that.
But then she, like, at this point, what I think made this admission something that actually ended up working for Kylie and not against her, and sort of, rather than having it be something that was damaging to her career, like, actually made, like, a major kind of shift in how we think about and receive the news that people do this kind of stuff, and, like, normalizing injectables, is that Kylie, leading up to this, she was a tastemaker. Like, people followed her on Tumblr. This was, like, the King Kylie era. This was when she wore the different colored wig. She'd be at Coachella. She was, at that time, considered the cool Kardashian to follow. She felt very different from her older sisters. Kendall's always been boring. Kylie, I mean, but Kylie was, like, dressing kind of, like, edgy within the bounds of, like, how a Kardashian dresses, but she felt different. And there were a lot of people that looked up to her as a tastemaker. And also, a lot of people generally considered it to, like, look good. Like, people wanted lips like hers. It became aspirational. She was selling her lip kits. Like, so I think another thing is just that, like, this was one of the first very public examples we had of someone openly having work done, and us generally, as a public, agreeing that they looked better with the work done, and that there was merit, or, like, we were able to understand why she got it, because we're like, yeah, that looks good. Like, guys thought she was very attractive. Like, it helped her. And I think that changed the way that, like, younger women started, like, viewing that type of thing.
Which has been very depressing.
But it definitely, like, yeah, it ushered in, like, this era of sort of uncanny beauty standards that dominated the 2010s. For her piece, Tolentino speaks to a celebrity makeup artist named Colby Smith. And at one point, she asks him if he thinks that Instagram face is making people look better. And he responds, "People are absolutely getting prettier. The world is so visual right now, and it's only getting more visual, and people want to upgrade the way they relate to it." And I found this idea really interesting, just, like, this idea of trying to keep up with a visual-centric society. Because obviously, like, we've always been aesthetically driven as human beings, and we've always pursued beauty. But do you think that maybe, like, we were almost saying earlier about when people have these Instagram faces and it doesn't really register with you? Like, do you think that having constant access to beautiful imagery almost lowers our tolerance for it and drives our, like, need to keep tweaking?
Like, yes, I think the more that we're inundated with images, the more that we're going to think that those images are real, especially if those images exist in a phone that we are addicted to and, like, use 24/7, like, we start to kind of absorb that phone as our own reality when it is not. And so it makes sense that it would start to shape the way that we see things. I think that we kind of briefly discussed that with the BBL even, like, you know, that does not look good in real life. It does not look real. But because we live in this, like, hyper reality of the internet, we think that like in our heads it looks good. Like it's almost like a mental illness, truly. Like you see some of the plastic surgery that some people get, or like the way that they face you in their photos, and you're like, wow, that's like not well, like something's up there. And that's the most extreme versions of it, but I do think it's absolutely shaping the way that we see things, in the same way that it was being shaped by like magazines of the 2000s, just, you know, in a more extreme way, because it like lives with us 24/7.
Yeah. I also just wonder if, because things are feeling more and more constructed to appeal to like some of our like more instinctual, I don't know, like some of our visual like and aesthetic instincts, that when we get to see them all the time, like they don't excite us in the same way. So we're like, yeah, we like need like a better fix of beauty. Like we want to be wowed by beauty, and it feels so hard to be struck by beauty. But I think that that's something that we get a genuine like positive brain reaction to.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Just the idea that there's like becoming a higher standard for things to be visually appealing, because our culture is so dominated by visuals
that it stops looking anything like resembling reality.
But and then like, because we still want things that are visually interesting and engaging, once things start reaching a higher standard of how they should look to appease us, we're not going to get that same experience when we see them. So things need to become more and more, I guess, like
the ceiling for looking good is just constantly being raised to the point that like it actually almost comes around looking bad. I mean, it feels almost similar to the way that we talked about porn in like the Sasha Gray episode, and the idea of, you know, like I think it's the harder and harder hypothesis, but yeah, you start to seek out more kinky porn essentially in order to like get that dopamine hit, and it feels almost similar,
yeah,
to that in some ways.
I think the age of information just across the board has like really fucked up our dopamine receptors, to the extent that like you don't need to travel somewhere to see what it would look like you don't need to be somewhere to experience beauty. Like things are just so accessible to us that like I don't think our brains get as excited by them.
So freaking true.
So for her article, Tolentino speaks to a few plastic surgeons in Beverly Hills, and during a consultation that she does with one of them, he pulls up a photo of her on Facetune so that he can illustrate what the results of different procedures will look like on her. And to me, this is like obviously just such a good representation of the symbiotic relationship between Facetune and these cosmetic procedures, because they do keep raising the stakes for each other, or like raising the bar. A lot of people seems like they were face-tuning or like looking at themselves through filters before they decided to get certain work done, because it allowed them to like see what they looked like with these different features, and then like grow accustomed to that and like prefer that over what they look like in real life. And after speaking to the surgeons, Tolentino finds herself struck by the practical and frank way that they discuss young women getting cosmetic work done. And she says there was a sort of cleansing, crystalline honesty to this high-end intersection of superficiality and pragmatism. And pragmatism is sort of like a recurring theme throughout this season, I would say. Because like, obviously there are a lot of reasons why choosing to enhance your appearance would be seen as a very practical decision. And I guess I never really know how to talk about like the specific individuals who partake in face tuning or getting injectables, because from like a feminist perspective, a lot of this does upset me, or like doesn't necessarily align with my values. But then I also like don't think that the girls in like the med spa waiting room like getting preventative Botox or injectables because they think they need it, like I don't think they're the villain here, or the girls even like face tuning themselves.
I mean, the going logic has just been to criticize like the system and not the people.
Yeah.
There are a lot of regular people who use their plastic surgery to make money on TikTok and Instagram and like promote it. Like even non-influencers, people are like, I just got this procedure, let me tell you how it went, like here are all the steps. That's where I'm like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Like I don't have any sympathy, or like I feel completely fine criticizing people who do that, promoting their plastic surgery. But yeah, I mean, no, I don't think that they should be like necessarily demonized for it, but I do think that argument has also been kind of weaponized to make sure that no one critiques it at all. I think you can do both.
I guess it's just because like I can like empathize, yeah, with why people would get it, that it yeah, obviously people who are promoting it are like a different camp, but like with just everyday people, it's like I sometimes feel bad about criticizing the act of it because I think it maybe like alludes to this idea that I think that I'm above those insecurities.
I think you can critique the act of it.
Yeah.
I think that our fear of critiquing the act of it is actually enabling it to continue. The people who say like, oh, you're a dumb bimbo for going to get that and you're so vain, like obviously that's bad. But I think most people are like, no, injectables are bad. I think plastic surgeons are bad. I think that the fact that we've convinced ourselves that this is going to make us feel better is bad. And I think that that's okay. I think you can critique the act of it. The act of it is harmful. A lot of the stuff is, some of it's reversible, some of it's not reversible. And like, it is contributing to a larger societal problem of raising this beauty standard that is extremely unattainable and like also Eurocentric and also XYZ, like, you know what I mean? Upholding this patriarchal ideal of beauty. No, I don't think that you need to critique the individual to do it, but I do think I'm like almost tired of the fear of not critiquing the act of it. Like, I think that that fear is what has led it to becoming so normalized. And a lot of that is done by women normalizing it.
It's
so
true.
I do think that there needs to be some internal critique there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it benefits people who do decide to partake in these activities to have it become destigmatized and normalized and like something that that's accepted, because then they can continue to do it more smoothly, I suppose. I guess, like, I think a lot of people, like, can identify a part of ourselves that, like, wants to or, like, has, like, thought about participating in these kinds of things, even if you wouldn't actually. But then I also think, yeah, like, for a myriad of reasons, we individually, but also, like, we as a culture are upset by people face-tuning, by people getting injections, like, by all of this culture. But I think that that anger then, like, it sets up people who do participate to be on the receiving end of what can be, like, very vicious backlash. Because I want to return to celeb face and, like, the Instagram call-out culture. So, obviously, like, a lot of the people who would get featured on celeb face were public figures with rather large followings. So, like, the Kardashians and Hailey Bieber and Tana Mojo are some, to name a few. But occasionally a model or, like, a content creator with a significantly smaller following and much less influence or power would still find themselves a target on the page. And this is what happened to a former model named Sarah McDaniels. McDaniels did not have a particularly large following when she ended up on the cover of Playboy in 2016. And I think she might have been the first, or at least was one of the first models to go on the cover during Playboy's major rebrand, which is when they stopped publishing fully nude images. They said they stopped using Photoshop. They started casting models that were outside of the sort of like blonde bombshell Playboy bunny look that had dominated the magazine during Hugh Hefner's reign. And so like this incentive to go in a new artistic direction led them to cast McDaniels because she was a model with heterochromia, which means each of her eyes are different colors. After her Playboy photo shoot, McDaniels fell on the radar of Slubface, and they accused her of faking her heterochromia using like photo editing softwares and then also different colored contact lenses in order to, I guess, like stand out in the modeling industry. She was reposted on the page at the time of like the article that I'm citing here, at least like over a dozen times, but that was like many years ago, so it could have been more since then. But yeah, she was repeatedly posted on the page, including childhood photos that had been sent in by her dad, who I'm just going to assume she had some kind of estranged relationship with. So following this, McDaniels says that she experienced really bad abuse online, obviously, and that from that she began experiencing panic attacks and depression as a result. I think she left modeling. I'm getting this information from an article by Emma Goldberg for Elle magazine, and she spoke to Celebface about the incident, and Anna, the anonymous owner of Celebface, told her that her page isn't meant to enable harassment, that its purpose is to help followers with the complexes they develop comparing themselves to touched up photos of already thin, attractive celebrities. But like, I'm kind of gonna call bullshit here. Having been a former follower of Celebface, and especially in a case like this one, where she was being targeted for faking a quirk, not for like trying to like uphold a beauty standard, what do you think is the actual motivation behind people following pages like this and like this type of like a content market.
Well, no, part of it is shame. I mean, we talked about like the rat brain earlier. I will admit, like in this episode, I don't feel good about using Facetune. I think it's bad. I think it's bad that I use it. I don't think that it's good that I follow celeb face. Like, I think it was fun for a bit. I feel like when the Kardashians, because they're so ridiculously powerful, like when they're the subject of it, I'll be honest, I don't really care. Mm-hmm. But like when it's other celebrities, it is like, okay, well, I do firmly believe in people's right to privacy. I think this job has made me feel that way more than ever. I do think that this is like a multivalent issue of like, there are many things floating about here, you know, like there's like the desire not to villainize the everyday woman sitting in the med spa waiting room, but there's the desire to be like, we all need to stop doing this. Like, can we stop participating in this? And then there's a desire to critique the system. And then there's also this other element to it with celeb face, which is like surveillance culture. Because recently that whole scandal happened with the CEO, the cheating scandal at the Coldplay concert, and his like head of HR or whatever. And someone that I follow, Tatum Hunter, who is a journalist for the Washington Post, described it as like a decentralized surveillance state, basically, or decentralized surveillance, which is like everyone coming together almost as like populist means of calling out bad behavior. But like the bad behavior in question is always like kind of strange, usually pretty like normal human bad behavior. Mm-hmm. But the punishment doesn't always fit the crime, the punishment of like public ridicule. And I think like in this case, it's like the punishment so vastly outweighs the crime. It's so clearly some sort of like surveillance system happening. And it's always in the name of moral righteousness. Like it's always done with this like morally righteous hand that is just a way of shrouding what is actually happening, which is like middle school bullying and like tomato throwing and like public square humiliation. But we don't want to admit to that, so it feels better to have the moral high ground. And that's, like, obviously what's happening here with celeb face. And I can see how that would intersect with the desire to laugh at celebrities, poke fun at them, be like, why do you look like this? And I'm sure, like I have certainly played into that when it comes to the Kardashians. But yeah, I strongly believe in if you have, like, a very large platform, blowing up another platform or, like, making them accidentally go viral or, like, invoking them at all, there's a lot of responsibility on your hands. This happens a lot with like YouTube video essays too, and like the call out culture that happens there. Like you do have a responsibility as someone with a larger following than the person you're talking about if you're going to be invoking them in that way. And so this is my really long-winded way of saying, yes, that's bad.
Well, yeah. And I think, I mean, in the case of celeb face, there was like protection was not even like a part of the equation. It was quite literally the opposite. It was like, let's bring everything to light that someone, like, I didn't realize that Ana de Armas had like so much plastic surgery done until that she started getting posted on celeb face all the time. She kind of done a good job at like showing up and like not having, like, she was an unknown and then she became famous and she had this different face.
It did really show the kind of Hollywood funnel of getting this like face constructed for you before you actually blow up. Like that's a huge thing in Hollywood that no one talks about because it's so subtly done. But like Ana de Armas' transformation has been crazy.
Yeah.
And she is the beauty standard right now, like one of the prevailing sex symbols of Hollywood right now. And it's like, okay, well, this is good to know.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And I think like when I followed celeb face, I think that was my mentality. It was like, well, I, like every woman on social media, feel like shit about myself, and seeing some of the like kind of dominant images and like beauty symbols of this time is making me feel worse. And I think you do get a satisfaction out of knowing like, oh, it's not that I'm ugly, it's that I'm broke.
This came into being at the same time that like a lot of top models were also just like Bella Hadid types who just had like extensive plastic surgery done. And it's like, okay, the whole point of modeling is that you're exceptionally beautiful, but then all of a sudden you can like buy your way into being exceptionally beautiful, and like that is validated by the industry. And like we could always say whatever we want about like the harms of the beauty industry and modeling, etc., to begin with, but like the fact that now that beauty standard isn't even like natural beauty, it was so confusing at the time, and now it's completely normal, like it's everywhere.
I think we had this like idea of a lot of industries like modeling but also Hollywood as sort of being meritocracies, which they've never been. I mean, modeling maybe a bit more so, but still, it's, I think like moving out of those industries though, like when everyday people do it, I think we like to poke fun at the vanity of Hollywood because that is very easy to do and it needs to be poked fun at a lot of the time. But I think that what social media has obviously done is, like, made us more vain generally as a culture and made the individual person more vain. And so I think that it becomes more complicated when, like, the people perpetuating this are people who are just unprepared for that kind of part of their brain to be opened up in such an extreme way. And maybe, like, some people who choose to participate in these things, it's like the idea that, like, we as a culture have developed bloodthirst for people who are, like, I guess conspicuously vain is the way I would put it, just makes me think a lot about, like, maybe this just ingrained notion that vanity itself is just inherently bad, even though we still exist in a society that views beauty as a virtue. This idea of, like, we love beauty, but it has to be authentic, it has to be natural, otherwise we get so angry by it.
Well, it's a feeling of cheating your way into something, yeah. I think. And, like, feeling shortchanged because someone cheated their way into doing that thing. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, going back to the concept of surveillance, like, it could have made us more sympathetic to the idea that celebrities are subjected to the, like, camera apparatus to, like, a significantly higher degree than anyone else and photographed from every angle. I will once again, I don't know if I've already, I probably said it on this season, but, like, I once again believe that, like, we are just meant to look at ourselves in the reflection of a pond and, like, nowhere else. Mirrors should not exist. I should not see every angle of my face. The reason everyone hates their side profile is because it's not because it's inherently ugly. It's because you're not supposed to see yourself from that angle. I'm not supposed to see myself from that angle. I can't be on the side of myself seeing myself like that. Why am I able to do that? And I think that social media has made that possible in every way, shape, or form. It's made us photographed like we are celebrities.
Yeah.
You know, social media makes a little celebrity of us all. They call it the demonic turn, but, like, demonic, more like. And I think that maybe could have made us more empathetic towards the celebrities we throw tomatoes at, to an extent. Obviously, I, once again, have a caveat for the Kardashians and the way that they've, like, promoted this to such a pervasive extent. But, like, instead, it's made us kind of be like, we still hate those people, and also let's get filler ourselves.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I mean, the season really just has made me think about vanity a lot and why our culture's so vain. And part of it is because, like, we have more leisure time than ever.
Because AI is doing our grocery lists for us and writing our emails.
Well, this is hard to say because the middle class has shrunk. So it's hard to say that necessarily everyone is, like, a leisure class, but we are a culture where most people have an iPhone, lower, upper, middle class, like, everyone has an iPhone. Everything's become more democratic, more available. Being fashionable has become more democratic and available, like, et cetera, by virtue of all these, like, different changes within industry. And I just keep thinking about how we have so much time to think about ourselves. Like, we focus so much on the self. I feel like we don't focus on things very much. We're so absorbed with the self in every way, shape, and form, whether that's through, like, wellness, whether that's through, like, therapy speak, you know, whether that's through beauty. And I'm just like, wow, I just wish we could focus on anything else and, like, experience the world not so internally. And, like, I say this as someone who was also focused on myself.
I've had, like, a very inward facing year because I've been kind of on my own for so much while I was traveling. I've spent the most time alone in my entire life this past year. And it has made me, like, almost, like, way too inward focused to a point where, like, I feel like a teenager again. And I'm, like, craving external engagement and, like, I'm craving external stimuli, I guess. Something other than, like, thinking about how I look and thinking about how I'm feeling. I don't want to think about how I feel.
Totally. I think that part of this is, like, the collapse of community and, like, the collapse of, you know what I mean, like, what humans I think we're meant to be in, which is, like, a village.
Yeah.
We were meant to live among people that we know. And I think that being alienated, being shut up in our rooms, this, like, introversion culture, which I'm a huge advocate against.
Maya is, like, anti-introvert. It's fascinating.
Well, because I think it's antisocial. Yeah. Like, I think it's asocial behavior. I think that it plays into, like, a very capitalist mindset, and no one wants to admit that. Totally everyone likes to recharge and be alone sometimes. I think being alone is important. But I also think that this, like, oh, I just stay in my bed all the time, I don't think it's healthy. I think that it's feeding into something that is actually a larger force at hand. And I don't think that it's people's fault, but it concerns me greatly. And I think that having more time to just sit on our beds, scrolling on our phones and looking at our selfie cameras is, like, unhealthy, both to us and also, like, so unproductive. not to the economy, but to the world at large, you know?
And I think that, and this is something I was thinking about a lot, like, researching this episode, is that I just think there's something inherently antisocial about Facetune, because what it's doing is it's making the primary representation of yourself your digital avatar and your image online. And so even if the way you look in real life doesn't align with how you look online, you're choosing to prioritize the way you look online. And you're, like, kind of accepting the fact that that is the truer version of yourself, which I think does expose the way that we, like, lean on technology to maybe, like, fulfill these needs that aren't supposed to be met. Like, we're not supposed to be able to look however we want, because that's, like, not really part of the human experience, I suppose. And I just think that, you know, the internet and technology has made everything so easy to us, or just, like, brought things so much closer to us. I don't know. I just think it makes sense then, like, why there are incoming generations who prefer that life to, like, an external life. Because, yeah, if you're insecure about the size of your lips or your nose or something, wouldn't you rather exist in a world where you don't have to face those insecurities, where you can fix them? And I think it's, like, this very addictive, like, very seductive possibility to people, I suppose.
But then ultimately that world is locked between, like, the four corners of your phone, you know what I mean? And the four corners of, like, a frame of an image on your Instagram grid.
Yeah.
And that is antisocial, and it is sad. This season has been, like, generally quite depressing. I've definitely taken away from this season this question of vanity and, like, what it means, who gets to be vain, if vanity is necessarily bad, like, all these questions. I think that's been kind of the prevailing question for me this season.
Yeah.
What has come up for
you? I just think, like, funnily enough, because I have a rat brain, it's, like, for as much as we've been, like, dissecting and breaking down and challenging certain vain notions, the rat part of my brain is also then starting to think about these things. Like, I just find that, like, vanity is a snowball. It really is. It is something that we can all outwardly acknowledge can be bad, can be damaging, is maybe consuming so much of our time. The endless pursuit of beauty is fruitless and also just oppressive for women. And yet, I guess there is just, like, something conditioned, like, so deeply within us that makes it so difficult to actually reject it. And I don't know, like, part of it, I think, is tied to, like, womanhood, but then I think we're drawn to beautiful things. I think that human beings are drawn to beautiful things. That's why when things are ugly, it's a statement. Because, like, how do you, like, separate that desire that's, like, inside of you from, I guess, you know, also taking a stance against the ways that that, like, intrudes on your life?
We still live in it, though, you know? Like, it's hard to formulate another idea of beauty when, like, we live in this Western world. It's the same as, like, oh, you critique capitalism, yet you have an iPhone. And it's, mm-hmm. like, well, we are set up in this society. And to be honest, the boldest, bravest thing I could do is go get a flip phone.
Yeah.
But I'm not, because I think convenience is the most important thing. And I do think a lot of what these pursuits of beauty are pursuing convenience. Like, it is more convenient to be beautiful. It's more convenient to feel beautiful. Like, if I just look this way, the belief is, like, well, I don't have to think about it anymore. You know what I mean? Ultimately, that's never the truth, but you're like, if I just attained this body, if I just attained this face, like, I won't have to think about this all the time. I can think about other things. But it's not that, because it's, you know, the hamster wheel. I do think we're attracted to beautiful things. I mean, do you remember that era where we grew out our armpit hair?
Yeah.
And dyed it?
Yeah.
Like, I was growing out my armpit hair there for a while. I felt like when I lived in Montreal, I felt actually really comfortable with being a little more natural, I guess, like, a little more free. And I felt like the beauty standards there felt significantly less oppressive. I felt pretty liberated there, honestly. And then I moved to Toronto, which is, like, fucking spandex filler capital of the world. And, like, immediately my beauty standards shifted again. And I started wearing, like, more makeup. I, ever since, have been shaving my armpits. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I got laser hair removal, which is a completely permanent procedure, essentially, if you do it right. Or if it works on you. And that was with the presumption that, like, I'm pretty sure that this beauty standard isn't going to change in 50 years. So whatever, I'll just, like, never have to think about this again. And I tell everyone that I'm really glad I did it. But that was feeding into a beauty standard. And, like, I like to imagine a world where that thing didn't exist. And I think a lot of people have trouble doing that.
Months ago, I was packing up stuff at my parents' house, and I found like an old journal of mine from when I was 18. And the stuff that I wrote in there, I was like, oh, this girl like had it way more together. Like, she was way more confident in those types of things. So I was, I hate to say it, like a better feminist, I guess, or like I lived more to those values at that age in a way that like if you tried to challenge me on that, I'd bite your head off. And I used to like get hairstyles because I thought they looked sick, not because I thought I looked pretty with them. In fact, I think I looked quite bad with some of my hairstyles from that era.
You didn't. I thought you looked good and old, actually.
Thank you. I had I used to cut my hair myself to my chin, and then I had, it was like bleach blonde. It just like didn't look.
Yeah, it looked cool. I liked it. Again, that's your brain now telling you that it's not pretty.
I think I just like prioritized things that I thought were cool or interesting over beauty, and I don't really know when that changed. Like, I actually can't really trace it, and I don't know if it had something to do with like getting older or with like the environments I was in changing, because obviously I was coming straight out of art school. But I do kind of feel, I felt embarrassed when I was reading those old, because I expected to read stuff I wrote when I was 18 and cringing because I was like, oh god, how delusional I was. But I kind of feel like it was the opposite. I feel like I knew what was going on at that age in a way that I've really lost sight of.
Totally. I think the same way. And that also having more money than I had at that age, like over the past few years, you know what I mean? The ability to kind of like buy into certain things that like I could not afford a haircut. I was thinking about like I'm trying to get a nice haircut soon. And I was thinking about how like you should just like absolutely hack at my own bangs in Montreal. I didn't really give a fuck also what I looked like. I was pretty confident as well. But also like I have more money. Like, I have money to, like, not right now, but, like, you know, generally I have money to be able to buy a nicer haircut and, like, make sure it looks good. And I think that once you enter the adult world and you have to interface with people in different ways, you know, I'm in a very, like, visual job. You know, I recently asked people if I should get micro bangs, and they were like, no, you shouldn't, because sponsors like a pretty face and, like, sponsors like a middle parted haircut. And it's like, that is kind of somewhat the truth. And so it's, I don't know. I think it's just harder to be against the grain as an adult. But I think that that's cowardly of myself to say. And I do think that there is some cowardice going on in general. I say this on behalf of myself as well. I think that it's extremely brave. It takes like extreme amounts of bravery to push against those beauty standards. And I really like value the women online who do that and like have made kind of like careers out of, you know, like promoting different body types, promoting being hairy, promoting having a lot of acne. Like, all this stuff is not promoting it, but, you know.
Just being, like,
normalizing it.
Upfront with it.
That's really brave.
Yeah, I feel, like, superficial acknowledging that I think that those things are brave. But it's, like, it is true because I think we are lying to ourselves. If we tried to say that a significant amount of our, like, time on this earth isn't dedicated to obsessing with how we look and how we, like, present ourselves.
Exactly. Well, I think that this season's been illuminating. We have two bonus episodes coming up for you guys. One of them is about Sabrina Carpenter. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be on Patreon. And the other is also a Patreon episode. It's going to be a follow-up on this season, which will be about AI and beauty, which we're also really excited about. So stay tuned for those. We'll be posting about them when they come out. If you want to follow us on Instagram, etc. Next season, we hope to get to you guys much sooner.
So we'll see you soon. Thank you.